This is the applying what we've learned to the environmental, social, and economic crises of today panel. So if everybody would like to have a seat. I feel like I'm in school. Would everybody like to move more forward so the panelists don't have to yell? And they can feel close. Thank you.
You see Sharon? Yes. Yeah.
Okay, we have a very full panel, and what I'm going to ask the panelists to do is to take a minute at the beginning of their talks to introduce themselves and to give us a 5 to 6 minute presentation so that we'll have some time for discussion and questions.
But you have brief introductions.
I was going to...
No, you have. Why don't you read that first?
Because I don't...
She wants us to introduce ourselves.
Yes.
As part of our presentation.
Okay.
There we are.
Be modest.
And the order that I have is Mike Parker first, Jack Weinberg, Margie's, is she here?
We haven't
found her yet? Okay. Jackie Goldberg and James Van.
Who's James?
James Van. And Jack Rady?
He's not here.
He's not here. Okay. Well, he was he's not here. Ken Path?
Ken Path.
Uh-huh. I have you as a discussant.
I don't know what that means.
Did you know that?
I'm always willing to speak out. If
you're supposed to make sense of what we say.
Well, you know, at the end, just...
You've got more than ample up there.
I believe you. Okay. So are we ready? Mike?
I prefer to stand. First of all, those of you who don't know me, my name is Mike Parker. I was on the executive committee of the FSM. I afterwards went to Detroit for 30-some years working in the labor movement, particularly associated with labor notes. And then I moved to Richmond, California, a place that was selected by an accident of history. I hardly knew about it when I lived here, but luckily my wife's parents lived there, and that's how I ended up there. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. This is how many people heard the last session that was in this room? Okay, so for many of you, it was about coming up with the big ideas about what will unite everybody and bring everybody together. I have a slightly different view of the problem. I don't think the problem is coming up with the big idea. I think the idea actually is that people feel powerless, so that even small ideas seem out of reach for them. And that the way in which we give people a sense of power is by actually struggling for that power. That's our experience in the FSM, after all, from start to finish. We learned that by coming together, we had more power than we ever thought possible, and that directed us for most of our lives. Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit today about the struggle that's going on in Richmond, California, because in many ways, it's a continuation of the battle that we fought here and that we've been fighting for the past 50 years. Richmond, just for those of you who don't know, is actually a pretty poor town. It's about 40% Latino, about 25% African-American, about 15% Asian. It's a town without a university in it, without even a college campus in it until very, very recently. It's a working class and poor town. And yet, in Richmond, California, we've done some enormously popular things despite the fact that we've been up against one of the most powerful and most vicious corporations in the world. That's Chevron. Those of you who don't know about Chevron, Google it. Google Ecuador, Nicaragua, all kinds of places, and you can find the stories of murder, of intimidation, and it all goes on in Richmond. And yet, over the past 8 or 10 years, progressives have slowly managed to wrest at least partial political control from Chevron by building an independent political movement. We can talk about what that means at some other time. But what we've done is we've accomplished some things that other people take a look at. So, for instance, Richmond was one of the first sanctuary cities in California, refusing to cooperate with ICE. Richmond stopped driver's license checkpoints, which targeted Latinos. We were one of the first to battle, and we lost badly, but we were the first to battle the sugar drink industry. Now it's being picked up in San Francisco, Berkeley, in Mexico, and around the world. Richmond was the city which put on the map the idea of using eminent domain not to help move poor people out of their homes for the benefit of corporations, but to do the opposite. Use eminent domain to keep people in their homes to stop the banks from foreclosing. Richmond was a place where we battled Chevron to a draw on some of its projects, a place where we actually managed to force Chevron to pay more in taxes through using political organization and putting community and the grassroots pressure on the system. Richmond is a place where we're active in supporting people who are coming out of incarceration, a big thing that's happening in California, particularly in Richmond. In Richmond, we're the first city in Contra Costa, and the only city in Contra Costa County, to put in effect the minimum wage. And it's one of the highest in the Bay Area, despite being a poor city, $13 an hour phased in. So Richmond has a lot to be proud of. Chevron has decided that it does not like the fact that the city council and the city government have found ways to actually make demands on the corporation to reduce pollution, to pay more taxes, and to possibly even slow down its developments, which add to global warming. And so it wants to retake the city council. And it's spending millions of dollars and a massive campaign in Richmond to do that. $1.6 million is the official amount that it's spending. That's what they actually had a sign for. We say it's $5 million in direct money and about $20 million in indirect money. What do we mean by that? Chevron writes checks to every nonprofit that asks for it, as long as that nonprofit says it will not criticize Chevron. You can get $10,000 for anything written on the spot and more, as long as you're willing to not criticize Chevron. Now, how does Chevron actually do all this? Well, first of all, they do it with the obvious things. They actually buy candidates. But more than that, what they do is they set up an independent media, because Richmond's media poor. So they set up an online internet newspaper, which is supposed to be the community's bulletin board, and it is, and it works that way, except for the fact that they control the political line of this thing outright, something which actually publishes material attacking our candidates, made up of total lies, and pretends to be newspaper reporting because they've hired a San Francisco Examiner newspaper reporter to actually put his name on all of these things. Chevron sends out tons of mailings. Most of the mailings they send out, this is just a stack of hit pieces. These are the pieces against our candidates going out. This one here, notice a picture from Black Block at Occupy, right? Richmond needs new businesses, not one will scare them away. And they attack one of the candidates because he was a supporter of Occupy. Oh, my gosh. And then we've got here an attack on the mayor, for example. Because what? Because Richmond has a sister city, Regla, Cuba, and she actually went to Cuba to visit the sister city. And okay, or on her own time, she actually went to Spain and visited the Mondragon co-ops in order to see what model that might be for Richmond. That becomes taking international junkets instead of doing work for the city. So, I mean, I could show you, and anyone wants to look at some of this stuff. I mean, there's mailer after mailer after mailer. They managed to do the big lie over and over and over again. How do we fight them in Richmond? We have only really two ways to fight them. One is we build coalitions. We understand that there have to be coalitions of unions, of environmental groups, of people who are fighting various fights, such as fighting against attacks on immigrants and the like, and we work real hard to bring all those groups together to fight the same battle. That's number one. And number two, we wage what is probably for any city a massive grassroots campaign. It's really hard to do because we do it with all volunteer labor, no staff whatsoever, because we don't have any money. Our candidates refuse to take any corporate contributions. We say the way in which you fight Citizens United, if you're really serious about fighting it, is you refuse those contributions, and then you make that the issue in the election about which side people are on. And lo and behold, you have all these wonderful politicians who are against Citizens United when it's in Washington, but, oh, they really love that Chevron money when it's made available to them. So we organize a grassroots campaign. We get people to go door to door. We understand that's the only way we can win, by building that kind of a political and social movement where people know each other. So that's going on now, not tomorrow, not yesterday. And if we win in Richmond, which I think we will, but it's never certain when you're going up against all that money and all that power. If we win in Richmond, it's a big victory for people and showing that people have power when they're trying to fight these corporations for equality, for all these other things that we're trying to fight. And if we lose, it will be just another example where the corporations can simply get away with what they want because they can buy most anybody out there. So the only thing I could ask is, after this discussion, I've got some leaflets I'll pass out. We're going to have more of a presentation on this on Tuesday at a telling you right in advance, it's a fundraising meeting here in Berkeley to try to get money to support it. If you know people in Richmond, you want to work in Richmond, hey, Chevron recruits people from out of all over the country to come work in there. We can recruit people who are coming because they believe in it. So that's the alternative. We have a chance of winning something real and important. And it was like the free speech movement. Not everybody was certain they were going to win, but they knew they had to make that fight because it was right. And in Richmond, we're making this fight not because we're certain we'll win, but because it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Hello. I still haven't figured out how, in 6 minutes, I'm going to say what I've learned over the past 50 years.
It's a tough one.
So I'm just going to start and run out of time and see what happens. After I stayed in Berkeley in California through the end of the 60s as an anti-war activist, I then worked auto plants, steel mills as a trade union activist. While I was working in a steel mill in Gary, Indiana, I learned they were building a nuclear power plant 5 miles from my home. And using the organizing skills I learned here in Berkeley, I organized a 3-county anti-nuclear campaign, which over a period of 5 years was able to stop the construction of that plant. That was the late 70s. Early 80s, and in the course of that, I rethought a lot of the things that I had. I started to rethink a lot of the ideas that I had coming out of Berkeley. I moved away from socialist and labor politics, although I remain very interested in labor issues and have many friends active in the labor movement. And I began to dedicate my time almost exclusively to environmental issues. Not because I think that's the most important thing. I don't think there is such a thing as the most important thing, but that's where I happened to be, and that's where I found that I could do something. I worked for 10 years for Greenpeace International. In the course of my working for Greenpeace, I had the privilege of working to promote the negotiation of a global treaty on a particular class of hazardous chemicals. And in the course of doing that, I was able to play an important role in organizing a network of organizations to initially support the adoption of a strong treaty. When the treaty was adopted, the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, we were very successful. It was adopted in 2001. The big environmental organizations like Greenpeace, like World Wildlife Fund, they were done. But we had mobilized organizations in Asia, from Africa, from Latin America to fight for a strong treaty. And they weren't done. Okay, now we got a treaty. What is that going to mean back at home? And so we, those of us who were interested, sort of reorganized or repurposed that network. The network, which started in 1998, and I still work with it, is called IPEN. What it stands for, I'm not going to tell you because the acronym is out of date, but we still have the name, IPEN. And it's a network of organizations, about 700 organizations in 115 countries, who are working on how to protect human health and the environment from toxic chemicals, from pollution, from products, from pesticides, and all that. And that's what I spend my time on. And I'd love to go on and talk about me and my work and the things I do and get you all excited, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say, what are some of the observations that I've made along the way and some of the rethinking that I've done along the way? And I'm reflecting on the conversation this morning about voter suppression. And here's a little story. There, a friend of mine, he works for the United Nations organization in Vienna, but he's African, and he's from the Darfur region of Sudan. And he was always feeling extremely bad about being in Europe when his country was going through such misery. And when Barack Obama got elected, when Barack Obama got elected, Barack, a person of African with African roots, getting elected president, he was so excited. This was so thrilling to him, and he had such high expectations. And I said to him, "Keep in mind, he's elected the president of the United States. That is, those expectations that he had were not realistic. Barack Obama was going to work within the confines of what a president, he might do it a little better, he might do it a little worse. He's going to work within the confines of what a president of the United States does." And that's one of the lessons I learned. When I was a young, more radical activist, I was against the Republican Party and against the Democratic Party and for revolution and could point out all the bad things that every politician does. I no longer think of what I do as anything to do with politics. Politics is one profession. It's about getting elected or getting power and then governing. By its nature, it is a give-and-take, coalition-building kind of activity. Politicians will never solve our problems. The best we can do, my opinion, is to get somebody elected who might create the conditions a little bit better than somebody else, and social movements are required. So what I see is my work these days is not in politics. My work, whatever issue I work on, is how to create the conditions where the opportunistic politicians, whatever their affiliation with, finds it more opportune to support the right thing than to support the wrong thing. And so I have very low I don't get angry. I have friends who send me emails about all the horrible things that every politician has ever done. I have very low expectations. They can do better. I can criticize them. I can try to get people to be angry with them so that they have to listen to them. But I believe that social change and politics are two important professions, but two very different professions. And that is, I believe, one of the main lessons that I've learned during a life of activism. I only give one. I don't know how much my time is, but am I out?
I think you're good.
What? Okay. I'll only give one more, and it sort of relates to the questions that we've been talking about, speech and free speech. We were right to fight that the authorities should put no constraints on our ability to speak freely. That's right, and I stand by that. But the question about what kind of speech do we then choose to engage in? And I define speech in the political or social arena into two categories. There's self-expression, and there's speech with the intention of having an impact. And I think there are two. They can. There's merge and there's areas. If I'm very angry, and it's opportune for me to express my anger, I'll express my anger. But if it's not opportune to express my anger, I won't express my anger. There are times when those merge. But in general, much of the speech, much of the communications that we see coming out of activist people, well-intentioned, trying to achieve things, is either of the character of self, how do I identify who I am? How do I signal to others the person I am? So I'm speaking in a way to project my personal identity. Or I'm speaking in a way to express my feelings, my emotions, my passions, my hate, my anger, my love. That's not political speech, in my mind, or that's not effective speech if you're trying to change policy. If you're trying to change policy and you're trying to change how people behave and you're trying to impact the world, then when you're involved in communications, you know, you have to be thinking, who are the people that I'm trying to reach? What are the words that are going to reach them? What are the pictures that they're going to identify with? I'm having a demonstration or I'm having an action. What is the photo that I want to see in the newspaper? I think that we did a very good job, but I think that the kind of struggles that we have to wage now and the kind of effectiveness that the right wing has had with their communication strategy is astounding. And I believe that to have an impact, we have to think about communications as not just something incidental to our activity as human beings and our what we write or what we think, but how do we communicate in ways that have that maximize the impact we have on the audience we want to have. So we could go for hours on this topic, but that's the best I can do in the few minutes I have. Thanks.
Well, as a person who was elected to political office for 22 years, I'd like to say I agree with you. When I left Berkeley, I went to the University of Chicago and got involved in the Students Against the Rank, which was when the universities were asked by the folks who did selective service to rank students, male students, and the bottom quarter would lose their student deferments. And this was particularly harsh at the University of Chicago because the undergraduates, who are only 2,000 students, thought that they had been taught that the university was an ivory tower, something we here at Berkeley never believed. So I came in and I said, no, never an ivory tower. They're all involved. They're in bed with the government. You know, don't believe it. And that demonstration really changed a lot of the environment and sit-in at the University of Chicago because the undergraduates began to look at the fact that their university was in compliance with all of the nasty stuff that was going on that they opposed. That, for me, was a beginning of seeing that you can learn thing in one place and help other people in another place, that each group doesn't have to start from scratch. But the question is, how do you talk to people about your experiences in a way that isn't demeaning of them, which doesn't make you sound arrogant, doesn't make you say, I know because I was there and you weren't. And that's really an important part of communication, because communication really is two-way. They knew the university far better than I did. I had just arrived. Okay? They knew what was going on there. The disconnect was is that they believed their professors, all of whom had them call them by their first names, John and Red and Steve, and that sort of made them all very close, and they trusted one another. And I kept trying to say to them, but they have another agenda than you do, and the university has another agenda than you have. And because we were able to talk to one another, and I wasn't trying to say, I'm the person who came from Berkeley, I know. And in fact, my whole first year there, I didn't mention I'd ever gone to Berkeley. It was the newspapers that outed me. When the sit-in started, they said, former UC co-ed leads UC demonstration, because both were UC, right? They thought that was very funny. But I learned a lot about working with people
who had different experiences than I had had. And I think that's really a very important thing, because if you can only communicate with people who've had similar experiences, your world gets smaller and smaller as opposed to larger and larger. And if you want to make an impact in any way, you have to be able to make things get larger and larger. People have to be able to buy into something. I learned also when I came back to L.A. that as a classroom teacher, first of all, I couldn't get a job for a long time because I was blacklisted. And I learned as a classroom teacher that in low-income areas, that people didn't give a damn about the kids so much that I could teach anything I wanted. And that was really exciting. I had just the best time teaching in Compton for 20 years. And I became the president of the Compton Federation of Teachers, and we really didn't make much impact because it was really a very low-income district and there wasn't much you could do. But I began working with people in the labor movement through my being a president of a local teachers union, and I began to understand that labor alone didn't seem to be able to get very far without the community. And the community didn't seem to be able to get very far without working with labor. And we began in Compton to put together organizations of parents and community members who worked with the Compton Federation of Teachers, and we began changing the school board. Because, of course, none of the teachers practically lived in the district, but all of the aides did, and all of the parents did, of course, and we began to see some change there. However, while we were doing this, there was the school desegregation case in Los Angeles, in which they woke up one day, and I know this will come as a shock to you, but they found out that this big district was segregated. And they thought, oh, my God. And so the ACLU and the NAACP and MALDEF all sued the school district. But here's an interesting thing that happened to us. We started an organization called the Integration Project. Why did we have another organization when there were three major organizations fighting against it? Because all of them wanted to see school racial issues as black and white. Well, that's fine if your city is black and white, but Los Angeles isn't and wasn't then. It was Latino. It was Asian Pacific Islander. It was a whole lot of people who were a mixture of groups and races. And so we started out to be an organization that intervened in the court case to say that if you want to really desegregate a district like this district that Los Angeles is, with at that time 600,000 students, that what you really have to do is you have to build communities of interest that say that schools should be multiracial, multiethnic. And, oh, my goodness, you would have thought, I mean, all of the organizations really opposed us. They thought this was a terrible idea. But we grew in stature and size, and we became a part of that case. Unfortunately, a legislature put on the ballot that you couldn't use a bus to desegregate a school, so it really didn't matter what the case did after that because it passed overwhelmingly. I suggested helicopters and trains and bus and other things, but people weren't buying into that, so we had to move on. At that point, there was an opening on the school board. And our group, the Little Integration Project, we turned on each other and said, you run, no, you run, no, you run, no, you run. Finally, they sent me out to dinner with one other guy in our group, and I don't know if I won or lost, but they came back, I was the candidate. So now we have another organizing opportunity. But this organizing opportunity is very different than the other ones, because up until the election just before the one I ran on, everybody was elected to the LA School Board citywide. That meant, if you know the geography of Los Angeles, almost all of the elected people were from the San Fernando Valley or from Westwood. There was not a single elected official south of the Santa Monica Freeway, which is two-thirds of the city, okay? And certainly none from the east side, which was largely Latino then and is even more so now. So we got on the ballot a proposition to say to elect people by districts. Now, if you want to talk about any chance of making electoral politics a useful tool for progress, you have to get elected from a district. Citywide means the party's over before you begin. Okay, so now we had a chance to get me elected. And why did we have a chance to get me elected? Because when we came out of college in the 1960s, I moved into a part of Echo Park in Silver Lake, which is in the center, just a bit west of downtown, a multi-ethnic, multi-racial community. Not anymore, but it was then. And we began to say, how do we get people to come together around things? And we started something, are you ready for this? The Echo Park Silver Lake Food Conspiracy. All right? All right. Now, what was this? What was this was we had Latino neighbors, we had African-American neighbors, not too many yet, we had Asian neighbors, and we had ourselves, and we began, I began, and others began, every time an apartment came open in those areas, we would call somebody we knew at Berkeley, and we'd get them to move there when they were moving back to Los Angeles. This is no joke. We spent 10 years populating that area with people that we knew from the 60s. Why? Because if you want to organize deeply in a community, you can't do it with two or three people. And there was, at that time, about 40 of us living in Echo Park and Silver Lake. And then, oh my God, what did we have? A big break. All the Catholic priests and nuns were leaving that were progressive. And they moved to Echo Park and Silver Lake. And now we really had them. Because the Latinos were Catholic, and here were all these priests and nuns knocking on their door, talking about what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. We all learned a lot about that. And the rest of us were talking to our neighbors about all of the things. And what we did is we had a food buying co-op. You put in $5. That's all you did one time, whether you were one person or 20 people. $5. You got a job. We sent four of us with a panel truck downtown to the real market for all of Los Angeles. We found a few people at first and then made finally a lot of people who would sell to us. We would then bring them to somebody's home from 3 to 6 p.m. Everybody who had paid $5 would bring their bags. We'd weigh the stuff. We'd sell it. We had three small restaurants in the community that bought anything that was left over. We did that for 10 years. For 10 years. And what we ended up with was a base to run a progressive for office. That wasn't our goal. Our goal was to get people agitated about the price of food, to get people agitated about the Vietnam War. We took a chapter from the Cuban cigar factories, and we had a reader who read news as people shopped. We had a child care center that came out of it, a summer camp, the Little Red Summer Camp. I was involved with that one. We had a child care center that still exists today that is trilingual. That is trilingual today. Okay? We did all of these things starting with the notion that people who come together to work together to get inexpensive but wholesome food have a common base for organizing other things. That was my base. We got a new library branch. Our area had never had a library branch. One of the oldest parts of the city of Los Angeles, they never thought it was important to put one in our area. Why? Weren't enough books taken out. Okay? So they put a bungalow on there, and we had everybody in the food conspiracy go and check 15 books out every other day. Well, our circulation numbers went way up. Suddenly, they decided they were going to build us a library branch. We began to see that if we could look at Los Angeles, not as a city, which it never really has been, but as a series of communities, and we could organize by communities, we could make an impact. Then I get elected to the school board, where I got rid of corporal punishment. It was the first district in the state of any size that got rid of corporal punishment. I'm sorry, you don't hit somebody because they're smaller than you. You know, if you're not going to hit them when they're bigger than you, then you don't get to hit them when they're smaller than you. That was the rule, and we got rid of corporal punishment. We had the first peace curriculum. So then I say, okay, fine, I've had it 8 years. The money comes from Sacramento. It was terrible. I was losing my hair. We were cutting everything. I went back to teaching for a couple of years, and then people said, well, we want you to run for city council. Well, I didn't really want to run for city council. But it turned out that there were two gay men running that the gay community did not like. And they said, I'll be damned if that's going to be the first openly gay person on the Los Angeles City Council. You're a lesbian. You go run. So I did. And I became the first openly gay person on the LA City Council. But here's another piece. Remember, we talked about community and labor, right? So labor had decided that they wanted to do something about a living wage because Baltimore had passed a little tiny one and it was, you know, going to be the end of the world, said people on the East Coast, then they needed a big city in the West to do this. So we took it on. We took it on with a mayor who was about as conservative, rich guy, Dick Reardon. Oh, my God, what a pain in the... Yes. Anyway, so he fought us, got all of his rich friends to hire all these front organizations, literally, to come in and say a living wage is the worst idea you could possibly have. It'll put all the black and brown and Asian small businesses out of business. We kept saying to them, how could it put them out of business when you're all having to pay the same wage? See, be different if you had to pay one group different, and these guys didn't have to. It turned out that we were able to pass the living wage. It took 13 months. It took every union in the city, and then we were lucky again, because now there was a group called the Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, CLU. And all of them provided all these wonderful demonstrations in their churches and synagogues and mosques and everywhere. And we began to take the religious community and the labor community and the progressive community, and we began to put together an organization that not only passed the living wage on its first trial, but the people who were not able to vote for it because they represented districts that might really not like it left the room in order for there to be no votes, which meant it passed on its first reading. Unbelievable. Nobody could believe it. Reardon vetoed it. We overrode his veto. I can't tell you how few times the City Council of Los Angeles has overridden any veto of any mayor. Okay, why did that happen? It happened because we did not try to do it as a political move. We did not try to do it as a labor move. We did not try to do it as a religious community move. We did not try to do it as a community move. We tried to do it as everybody pushing in the same direction. And really, that's basically what I have to say, is that it takes a lot longer to get into the battle when you have to do all of these other things first. But if you don't do those other things first, you turn around and really there are four people behind you. Not 400 or 4,000 or 20,000, but four. You're not going anywhere with four people behind you. They then talked me into running for assembly. I'm very, very sorry I agreed to that. That was the worst 6 years of my life. But we did get domestic partners, which was a domestic partners that was everything that marriage was. That was a tough battle, but we got it done. We also got a school bond that finally got all of the schools that were in overcrowded status and multi-track year-round and double sessions. We got them money to buy their way out of it. All again, the same thing. If you're going to support an elected official for office, let me tell you the most important question to ask them. Do you care about getting reelected? If they say yes, don't bother. Because the only way you are free is to say, actually, what would be the worst thing that happened? You're going to send me back to my classroom that I dearly miss? You know, put me in the briar patch. I'd be very happy to go back to teaching. And I meant it every time I ran. And as a result, I never lost an election. Thank you very much.
Stand up. People will hear
you. Yeah, you can sit if he wants. Let the guy do what he wants.
Well, I'm going to try it sitting down because I want to race through a lot of dates and things. I'm James Vann. I graduated Berkeley in '63. Jack occupied the Berkeley police car in Sproul Plaza in '64. And actually, after I graduated, I joined Richmond Congress of Racial Equality, Richmond Corps. Jack, when he was arrested in Sproul Plaza, he was a member of Berkeley Corps, and he was tabling in Sproul Plaza, recruiting, giving out information to Berkeley students and recruiting people to go on the freedom rides in the South. So that's one connection. I graduated in architecture, and I am still a licensed practicing architect in California. But Today, I'm a community and housing and political activist, I guess, in Oakland, California. And it's been a kind of a road to get to that. And so before I discuss some of those things that I'm doing today, I'd like to kind of race through a little of the history since Jack occupied the campus police car and bring us up to today. After the incident in Sproul Plaza, there was a lot of civil rights activity going on in the Bay Area. CORE was very active in a lot of that, a flurry of activities. And it was also a time when there were a lot of anti-war activities as well. Number of demonstrations, marches, movements against the Vietnam War, and also CORE was carrying on battles against racial discrimination at the time as well. The left that came together out of the free speech movement in 1966 decided that we wanted to move into politics. And we decided that, well, we had began a lot of the different formations, socialists, community leftist organizations in the Bay Area. We came together and we formed what's called the Committee for New Politics, CNP. And we decided to run Bob Scheer for Congress against Jeffrey Cohalen, who was the congressman from Berkeley at the time. Jeffrey was a liberal congressperson. But we didn't think his stance went far enough in opposing the Vietnam War, so we ran Bob Scheer for that. Bob got 45% of the vote. He won all of Berkeley, but he didn't win enough of the district to be elected. And that took a toll on the left movement at that time. However, there were a number of people who wanted to go further in politics, and so beginning in around 1967, 68, groups of people started to get together and form what was the Peace and Freedom Movement, not the party, the movement. The philosophy was that we wanted to have a movement, and if the movement became strong enough, then we would make the movement into a party, and the party would be subservient to the movement. So by 1968, we actually had collected enough signatures statewide to put the Peace and Freedom Party on the ballot. So the Peace and Freedom Party was born in 65. From 67 to the 1970s, continuing anti-war activities, rallies, teach-ins, marches, and in 1969, the battle for People's Park began. Michael Delacour, who was sitting in back, had put out a manifesto that the university who owned the property and was planning to put a student parking lot and athletic fields on the property, wrote a manifesto saying this should be a land for the people. It should not be used by the university. And so the battle for People's Park started, which went until about 1969, when the city of Berkeley leased the property from the university and did turn it so that it could be made into a people's park, which it still exists today. That the Battle of People's Park involved an awful lot of students. There were marches, and this was also the time that Governor Ronald Reagan wanted to prove his get tough policies, and so he decided that he was going to take over the land to push the people out. He sent in the California Highway Patrol and the Berkeley Police. who ultimately pushed out the people who were occupying People's Park, put an 8-foot fence around it, and claimed it back for the state, I guess, or for the university. But anyway, by 1969, and that remained a bone of contention until in 72, the city leased the property from the university, and it remains People's Park today. 72 to 80 was the national, basically a lot of activity around the national civil rights movement, which continued to gain momentum. However, as we moved toward 1980, we began to see the civil rights movement beginning to morph more into, there was more and more concern about the environmental movement began to take shape, and the feminist movement. The slogan, "Give Peace a Chance," began more and more to be morphed into "Give Earth a Chance." 1970 saw the first Earth Day, which again came out of the analysis of the New Left that had formed from the free speech movement. 1967 was the human being. In fact, the years 1965 to 1975 was really an exciting time to live in the Bay Area, and probably in other parts of the country too. The whole student movement and those who were associated with the student movement really came alive, as so much was going on. The human BN came about in San Francisco in about early 67, which began to be popularized by the hippie culture, the free love movements, and that led to the Summer of Love in San Francisco and Woodstock occurring about the same time on the East Coast. But the Bay Area became a real magnet for a lot of activity around civil rights movements and demonstrations, the rise of the rock band culture, magnet for many young people who came to the West Coast during those years. Right after that period, though, from about 75 to 80, there was sort of a lull. There was not many things going on. By 1980, there were some of the leftists who began to think, let's rejuvenate the left movement and begin to try to bring people together into progressive alliances. Oakland attempted to form an progressive alliance, and it didn't really take on. Well, Mike's Richmond Progressive Alliance is really flourishing and is a real model of what that kind of thing should be, and a lot of people ought to really look at that. So there were those sputtering attempts that took place in the early 80s. Then in 1984, Jesse Jackson announced that he was going to run for president. This proved to be very exciting and became a thing around which many of the kind of left movements that we've been trying to pull together and trying to keep going really became very excited about Jesse's campaign and the things that were being talked about in the campaign, the issues that were put forward. It really seemed to gel the things that the left wanted to see accomplished and wanted to, so they flooded into the Jesse Jackson campaign. In fact, the Jackson campaign was the first campaign or mass movement that reached out to all segments. There was every kind of grouping that got involved with the Jackson campaign. Over and above African Americans for Jackson, there were Jews for Jackson. There were even Arabs for Jackson. Latinos for Jackson, every kind of movement you could think. It was really an exciting kind of movement. Of course, Jesse didn't get very far in the 1984 election, but he ran again in 1988. And Jesse also started a movement around the campaign called the Rainbow Coalition. And the Rainbow Coalition really took off and proliferated. Chapters were formed in just about every state, every major city. And the Rainbow Coalition was beginning to, they were kind of autonomous and could take on activities in their own districts, some more active than others. But the chapter movement was very effective. So Jesse decided to run again in 1988. And in 1988, he got over 5 million votes, some 21% of the primary vote. However, when he went to the Democratic Convention, even though he got 21% of the vote, won a number of states, they allowed him only nine delegates. So Jackson became disgusted, disillusioned with the Democratic Party. He bolted, with the Democratic primary, bolted from the primary and really began to do a lot of nonsensical kinds of things, which resulted in the devolution of the Rainbow Coalition. There are various reasons as to why that may have happened, but that was something that caused a lot of people to really feel a letdown, because we began to think that the Rainbow Coalition could one day, if it continued to organize, hold the kind of mass audience that it had begun to attract, might one day become a kind of people's movement, a people's political party. The 1990s continued with small, after the Rainbow Coalition devolved, a lot of small, disparate efforts attempting to put out a political message. Some of those were the rise of the Green Parties, progressive networks in various locales, Students for Environmental Action Coalition. One of the things that I was asked to join was the National Committee for Independent Political Action, which I did join. And the National Committee for Political Action was not an organization, but it was a coalition of organizers and leaders who came together to form the sort of philosophical base for a new party, for a new movement, putting out papers that went into some of the issues underpinning that. And there were a lot of very influential names and we put out a publication. One of the things also that the National Committee for Independent Political Action did was to spin off an organization called the Independent Progressive Politics Network. The Independent Progressive Politics Network did put on conferences, workshops, reached out to all the parties, and was an effort to try to keep going the independent political party movement by reaching out to all of these different factions in various parts of the country, bringing them together to try and come up with uniform platforms, ultimately to move toward a uniform party. So there were various activities that occurred. One of the other ones, of course, in the Bay Area was Crossroads Magazine, which I was a part of, and we put out a magazine that was actually broad-based, had many people from various factions of the left who contributed to the magazine, and it lasted for about 8 years. But all of these efforts never had the mass base that they were meant to have. We never were able to develop, as I say, this mass base. Ultimately, I was out of the state. I came back to California and began to get involved in housing issues. We saw in Oakland very real needs for housing, so we tried to put together on a ballot to get a real progressive form of rent control. We weren't able to get rent control in Oakland, but we managed to get something little less than that. We ultimately did pass circulated petitions and passed an eviction control measure, so that stopped a whole lot of evictions in Oakland. We continue to work. My work today continues to be in housing, trying to get affordable housing, trying to assist tenants in their efforts to maintain their housing, and in a lot of the issues around harassment of people in housing, immigrants, and so forth. And so all of that, I think, led up to some of the work that I'm doing today. And I'll stop there.
Okay. Is this working? You promised me? All right. My name is Ken Paff, and I have I had a different experience in the FSM from these great speakers and leaders. I had arrived at here at the Big U, as I called it, a couple weeks before the FSM broke out. I was a hick kid. I came on a Greyhound bus. Well, to make it short, I kind of got involved, maybe slowly at first, and then fell in love with the movement, the FSM, the civil rights movement, and what we called then the movement. I was involved in many of these things. I worked pretty much, I had a job, I went to school, and I worked full-time for Bob Scheer. I worked for the Peace and Freedom Party and those groups. And really, I like being here. I want to say thanks to everybody who built the movement. You didn't just change my life. You just set the course for my life. And really, I haven't changed in 50 years, and I don't have any regrets from it. I mean, the new left... I should give a disclaimer from my dear mother. If she was here, she would not give you thanks because she did not think quitting Berkeley's physics graduate school and being a truck driver in Cleveland was the right plan for her baby son. Probably some of your moms were disillusioned. I don't know. I know mine was very deeply. I'm the national organizer of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, an insurgent rank-and-file movement within labor. And I've been doing that since I had hair for about 38 years. I'm very involved in another movement called Labor Notes, which is kind of like our movement, but throughout labor, and not just in labor unions, but in immigrants' rights and worker centers, organizations, and other movements of working people in this country. The new left at its best, and there was worst, and some of those worst, and self-indulgent was used by Jack and so on earlier, at its best was about participatory democracy, was about getting masses of people not just involved, but becoming leaders. And we tried, a number of us decided we would take that impulse into working class organizing. We weren't going to have a 10-point program, as Jackie said. We were going to take the struggles of working people, take our organizing skills to link people together, to help develop new leaders, to generalize struggles. And that's been going on, I guess, for most of the intervening 50 years. I guess after 50 years, how have we done? Apparently we haven't won because working people and poor people are getting their asses kicked regularly. So I can't say we won the game. But we have been able to build a movement in my specific organization that I'm involved in and in broader sister organizations. And we have been able to win a lot of victories, large and small. And if you're not building power and you're not winning victories, you're not going to have those followers. You'll be lucky to have 4, let alone 4,000. And I've certainly learned that. In the past year, the largest labor contract in the United States, the United Parcel Service, the world's largest transport corporation with 250,000 workers, were all in the Teamsters. And it probably wouldn't surprise you to hear that New York City's a gigantic unit. The New York metropolitan area within that. that the leadership of that unit's with our movement. We won the largest pension increase in the union this year, a $400 a year increase to $4,000 pension if you retire 30 and out in that unit. So we have to score those victories as we go along, and obviously we advertise them to others and tell people that if you fight back, you just might win something. The fact is, most of the time we're on the defensive. We won a victory this year for 100,000 people to defend their health care, and all it was to keep from having cuts. And in this day and age, that often counts as a victory.
You bet.
Just to have your health care not cut. And that is a lot of what we're working on. I think mostly, though, we're building a movement. You've got to win victories. You've also got to change people, change ourselves, get more leaders, and convince ordinary people they can become extraordinary people and be leaders. That's not easy. We don't find, we don't use that word. When I go to a meeting, if this was a meeting of newish people in our movement, a bunch of blue-collar workers sitting here, I wouldn't say I want you people to be leaders. They'd all get nervous and say, he's crazy. We have all kinds of code words to work up for that, you know. The first one is activist. We're looking for a few activists, and so on. And we have been able to develop a large core of leaders across the country. And it's harder to make people national leaders than it is to make them local leaders. I, after 38 years of working on this, I can tell you that. But we have been able to do it. It is, as the conditions in the country have worsened, more people are looking this way. Our recent Labor Notes conference had 2,000 people at it, from activists and people who just participate in worker centers to international union presidents and the postal workers and the ATU, the Amalgamated Transit Union, people that operate the BART trains here and so on. I was just visiting with the president of that union last night, as a matter of fact. And our goal is nothing less than building up a class-wide movement that can really change the balance of power in the country by changing it from below. Not by incremental changes of electing someone, as several speakers have alluded to. We've got to change the debate. We've got to take the issues. We've got to change the language. And we have to build the power behind that. In 1959, I'm just going to guess that if the chancellor, what's he called, the chancellor of the university, or a bunch of leftists or whoever were sitting around, they would not have predicted that 5 years later there would be the FSM. And in the movements that followed in the ensuing years. So I don't know when movements like that are going to break out on a broad scale, on a class-wide basis that can change the balance of power in the country. I don't even know, you know, I'm not promising it'll be in my lifetime. After all, I'm almost as old as most of you. I told you I was younger. But I know that, you know, I haven't had any regrets in the 50 years that you dragged me into this. And I hope that many of you are involved in these kind of movements, too. Thank you.
I want to open the floor for questions, but I'd actually like to ask the panel members to answer a question that I have, just short, and discuss it. And to say, if you had not been in the free speech movement, would your path in life have been the same? Were you already on a progressive path before free speech? Or how did that participation impact your lives? Maybe just go down the road, okay. Jackie, if you don't mind starting.
I don't mind. I think I might have continued on the same path because I had the previous year been involved in the ad hoc committee against the discrimination led by that extraordinary woman, Tracy Sims, who really changed my life. That was the change in my life. The FSM, however, gave me this notion that we could maybe win, which I didn't have from that, even though we won some things in San Francisco. It was contained, and I didn't have this feeling that you could take something on that was massive like the university and beat it. So I think it did have a big impact on me, but I think I was already moving along that line because getting arrested really does change your life if that's not something you had actually thought you were going to ever have to deal with.
No, I'm going to ask you, you were in a sorority, weren't you?
I was in a sorority. I was not only in a sorority, I was the pledge mother of the sorority at the time of the sit-in, and I made my pledges come into the building to rehearse for their pledge play that they were going to do in case I didn't get out of jail in time.
It was a civil rights movement that knocked me off my course. The free speech movement at the time was just part of that. That was just the next part of the civil rights movement. There was no boundary between them. And if that hadn't happened to me, I probably would have lived a life as a college professor of mathematics at a second-tier university. I think that's about how good I was. I would have been a college. I would have been a professor at a second-tier university, solving puzzles and problems of a purely mathematical character and keeping myself occupied. And instead, I had the good fortune of solving problems. I'm still a problem solver. I still see the world as a bunch of puzzles and try to figure out how to solve that puzzle to get the end I want. But instead of doing it in mathematics, I did it in social movements, and that was much more fulfilling.
Was it because the civil rights movement made you feel you could make change? Or that you had to make change?
That was the place where I really felt empowered was the free speech movement. But the thing was, I didn't know who I was or what I was I wanted to be, and I was a mathematician by default because there was nothing, I had to do something with my life, and I knew how to do that, and I was reasonably good at it. But it wasn't a passion. And suddenly I found I'm good at this. I know how to do it. I like doing it. It fulfills me. And so it was purely selfish. this was my career. This was my calling. And I found it at Berkeley.
Yeah, James Vann. Like Jack, I think it was the civil rights movement that really became the thing that bolstered much of what I became later on, because in the civil rights movement, well, the free speech movement, I'm not sure that there are a lot of things that came out of that affects society as a whole. Of course, it was an effect on the life of students and the students' ability to be able to express themselves and to seek their rights in the university, but it came about as a part of the civil rights movement, and the civil rights movement had the objective of trying to improve society, to end discrimination and to make the world better for everybody. And that was and the civil rights movement was in fact a movement where you were involved with a lot of people who shared the same kind of goal, and it was a long-term goal. So you were fighting and struggling to get that accomplished, and I think that's what became ingrained in me, the ability or the desire to want to fight and to make things better for today and for the future, and that's basically rooted in the civil rights movement.
I would have continued on. I had been active in the anti-war movement before this, the Student Peace Union, then active in the civil rights movement. But the one thing about the FSM, which I don't think anything else provided me, was the real sense that you could have massive changes of consciousness of people practically overnight. I mean, those of us we all went through that same experience, right? Tens or hundreds of people were involved at the very beginning, and inside of a matter of weeks or months, we saw tens of thousands of people willing to basically sacrifice part of their lives to be part of that movement. I mean, one of the small things that was just really notable to me, like when we were in the building, we'd yell down, "We need toilet paper," and people would go out and get toilet paper. "We need cameras." People would take their good cameras and we'd haul them up in a basket. I mean, everybody, there was a sense then of sort of community movement consciousness that you know, that's why we're all here. And that was gave me the sense that what we accomplished then, it could be accomplished by other people at other times. And in fact, I began to recognize that in struggles around the world.
Ken? Okay. Ready for questions? Start here.
I also think it was the beginning of the women's movement.
Mm-hmm. Could we do it on the mic for the recorder?
Those of us who felt particularly
Lynn?
Wait, she wants the mic, Lynn.
You want the mic? Pass.
Just so it gets recorded.
Because it wasn't, right, exactly.
Okay.
It was a... Some of us who were feeling a little disenfranchised by the power system, the power structure of the FSM, were moved, and who had the excitement of consciousness raising, were moved to continue with consciousness raising the rest of our lives. And so you can say the FSM changed the world, at least for some of us, in that way. And those of us who have leadership potential and didn't get to use it then, and are now using it in other ways, in other movements that are more opportune and offer more opportunities to women, can thank the FSM experience for that. So, yes, it was a way, way bigger than just this.
Hi. The question that I want to ask everybody here is, what do you do to increase solidarity on a grassroots level? But first, before I ask the question, I want to give some background. What I did now here in Berkeley, I've been in Berkeley ever since 64, is that I did what was called the Neighborhood Vegetables Movement, where we got people together to grow food for each other. We had garden work parties. And you'd get all your neighbors together and say, okay, I'm going to build you an organic garden. So we'd have 10 or 15 people helping to build that. And we had about 125 of them. And I've still got 3,000 people on an Excel file. But since not everybody gardens, only about 1 in 5, 1 in 6, I want to change that to, same initials, NV, the neighborhood village, where we share all skills and build also small groups, small classrooms and whatnot, one neighborhood at a time. So those are the things that I'm doing now. And I can't do that quite yet until I get a good computer programmer to do a database program. Anybody here? I'll talk to you later. Okay. But there were some of the things that happened in the 60s and 70s which didn't work because we didn't get enough solidarity. And because we relied on centralized organizations rather than on people getting together. One thing that happened in 71, the movement in Berkeley pretty well fell apart. One reason was that we elected an FBI agent to the city council, Darmy Bailey. And that's very well documented that he was that. Another reason was the rent strike, where you had a rent strike organization which said, okay, we've got 300 houses organized to go on strike, let's do it. And I said, no, you haven't done enough organizing yet on the grassroots level and got people really together to be solid. But they went out and organized anyway. And as a result of that, they didn't have enough people. People started getting dragged into court and getting triple damages for the rent that they owed. And so you would go around Berkeley to progressive households and find that the houses were empty because people had left town rather than face the court. And we decimated the community. This is what can happen for the lack of grassroots community organizing. I also want to say, you know, on you were talking about Bob Scheer running. What happened in the aftermath of Bob Scheer running? Do you remember that? Yeah. We got 45% of the primary vote, and there was a huge assembly in a school, about 600 people at that time. And they were all ready to say, okay, let's have an independent party and run anyway. Well, the chair of that meeting was the guy, I forget his name, who ran People's World newspaper for the Communist Party. And he said, no, we'll wait to make a decision. Next week came, he said, no, we're going to have another meeting a week later. That week came, no, we're going to have another meeting. Then the third week came, and it was pouring rain on a Sunday when the meeting was called.
Sir.
And the only people who, okay, I'll finish very soon. The only people who showed up were Communist Party members and me and a couple of friends, and they voted not to have an independent party. That's what happens when you rely on parties, even if you didn't, most of those people didn't know that it was happening, rather than grassroots organizing. Okay, so.
So the question is.
I repeat the question. What do you do for grassroots solidarity?
All right. Does anybody want to?
Well, I would say it's a very slow process, and you can't impose it. It develops out of common work together, out of building common values, out of valuing the views of other people and not just your own, and making the things that you strive for be the things that the people you're working with want to have happen, rather than something you come in from the outside and say, here's what I think we ought to be doing. And that's how you build solidarity. But anybody who tells you they can do it quickly has never done it.
You know, I left Berkeley around the end of the 60s, in large part because I felt things had become so superheated here that it was not the real world anymore. And I was engaged in this to influence American society. And if Berkeley was, if it was a whole country, we could have made a revolution, but it wasn't the whole country. So in terms of creating, you know, if you're trying to organize, I've worked in community organizing as well. Just two thoughts. First of all, when you're starting up, you're going to probably collect a bunch of misfits, a bunch of people who need friends, who have various personal reasons why they're coming on board, and that's okay. That is, you have to start with a base that you can start with. But, as Jackie said, you have to have an open line of communication with as many people as you can. You have to deal with issues that are important to people. And one last thing, the notion that you can have a high state of mobilization week in, week out, month in, month out, is a leftist illusion. Mm-hmm. That is, you can build up to peaks of mobilization, and during those peaks of mobilization, people are in this wonderful state. But don't confuse peaks with plateaus. You can reach peaks, but peaks are not the nature of the world. Plateaus are at a much lower level, and you have to build a plateau that you can try to time those peaks and organize those peaks.
We're sort of coming to a close. I want to make sure I see four hands, and I was trying to go this way, so I want to make sure I'm doing it right. One, two, three, four. Good? Did I get everybody?
No. I just want to mention
short questions.
The FSM actually started in 1960 when the House Un-American Activities Committee held hearings in City Hall. And around that time, there was also the California Loyalty Oath, over which many of the professors at Berkeley refused to sign. And that was the first major organization of Berkeley students who went down to City Hall because HUAC subpoenaed a Berkeley student. So I just want to give this little touch of historical background. FSM didn't just appear out of nowhere. And, of course, the civil rights movement was organizing. The women's movement was organizing. There was a whole body of work going on that contributed to it.
Thank you.
And you had the longshoremen, who were a big help in the civil rights movement in San Francisco.
The guy to your left.
So just a plea for some of us who did end up teaching at second-rate universities.
Second tier, not second rate.
Second tier, right. As somebody who wasn't an organizer but a participant, particularly in the civil rights movement, which had a profound effect on my life, I think for some of us here, what we did is we went back and tried to learn more about the bigger picture, theoretically, the structures, and that included going back eventually into the social sciences and teaching at a second-tier university and trying to think about the complexity of social change and how it occurs. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, it's so incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem of being an academic. But all these different things make a huge difference. And I think, in terms of my own work, I've had the most impact probably in my general education, huge study, you know, courses, because it was exposing students to ideas that they weren't getting anyplace else. And then in some of the applied anthropology work that I've done on race and on gender, which is really important. So I think all
of... Tell them the name of your book, because I love
How
it.
How Real is Race?
Okay.
Anthropological.
It's great. It's great stuff. I've been remiss in my job. Please state your name.
I'm Carol Mukopadai. So I just want to say that all of these things help to make change that everybody's been describing.
Yes.
See the gentleman.
Hi, I'm Theodore Vincent, and I introduced myself in the last session for some of you that were here. My question was, right now I run a Berkeley Hills goat herding program where I keep male goats in Berkeley by keeping them working because you can only have female goats in the city of Berkeley. And it's also potentially a food program.
Goat.
Yeah, I'm a goat herd. Yeah, goat. Animal with four legs eats plants. So, but the question is, and it's a beautiful thing because I get to interact with a lot of my neighbors. And my mother bought a house in the Berkeley Hills. It's dilapidated, but nonetheless, she's in the neighborhood. And I'm, for the first time in my life, interacting with all the Berkeley Hills neighbors and really creating some kind of sense of community in that area just because we're all sharing my goats, cleaning up backyards. But my question is, you know, I really look into Lynn's background and her philosophy, and I consider that really strong inspiration, where you have to deal with fundamental relationships before you can take a next step. You know, but the question is, as a local goat herd guy and a Berkeley guy, you know, what kinds of things, I mean, I feel like that's a step in the right direction, but, you know, how do I spend the other, you know, hours of my day to help you guys, you know, and interact with what you guys are doing to, you know, because I'm Berkeley focused. I've been here my whole life. I mean, you know, I did my master's in San Francisco and I've worked in office buildings for 10 years and I quit all that and left that all behind. But the issue is, how do I help you guys now that I'm self-identifying as a, you know, as a free speecher or as a revolutionary? And my goal is explicitly to support community organizing. Because, you know, Richmond is a beautiful place, and what you're describing is exactly the kind of stuff I'd love to be involved in, but I'm not sure that there's any way where I could really help as an individual. And I'd just like to hear the things that, you know, you guys recommend in that area, if you just, you know, have a few words.
One of our city councilmen is goats.
One.
He's running for mayor. We're supporting him.
I would just say it doesn't really much matter where you start. You pick something that you feel something about, that you think about and you feel about, and you think, this has got to change. And then you find people who are already working on doing that and saying, you know what, I'm going to come and see if I can help. There's so much in a society like ours that needs changing, you really don't have to look far. You can, you know, I'm in education, that's what I do. You know, I'm trying to protect the public school system from charters, okay? Why? Not because I don't like choice, but because the people who want choice want it only for a small number of kids whom they want to make elite, and the hell with the rest of you. And I happen to think that public education is important. But it doesn't matter what I think. It's what you think. And you pick something that's important to you and go get involved and spend your time there, and you'll find other people to work with.
So specifically, can I, as a Berkeley resident, help you when it's something you're working at in Richmond right now?
I'm not in Richmond. He is. Yes, I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can go door to door.
Yeah.
But we have one panel member from still in Berkeley, right?
The Progressive Alliance will take as much time and work as you can possibly donate and keep you very productively busy. And you might even learn things there that you can use for other organizing in other places. I'm speaking for Mike without consulting, but I think that's true.
Very true.
I'm looking at James, who's still here, right?
I'm in Oakland.
Oh, you're in Oakland. Well, okay, go ahead.
Hi.
Did you have any answer for him?
I'll have a couple comments at the end.
Oh, my turn? I'm Joan Gatton, and I do a open mic performance, an open mic series at the North Berkeley Senior Center, and the issue I'm bringing in is our senior elder needs, the critical need for nursing home reform, the critical need to keep talking. You're all, tremendously verbal, but most seniors are too polite to tell other people their opinions. If you lose your ability to talk as a senior, you have strokes. You can bring people back from strokes if you talk to them. There's tremendous need at our North Berkeley Senior Center and South Berkeley Senior Centers for volunteers. We started a oral history project kickoff. Were you here in 64? Do you have memories? I've got handouts. I live in Point Richmond in the eye of Chevron. It's a Chevron town. I was emergency preparedness team captain for many years, and they refused to be organized on a level of the whole community compared to the rest of Richmond. I retired from UC Berkeley. I made safety an issue because it wasn't in place here. We need school reform. We need to challenge the basic model of man as machine, and the idea that you should leave the personal and subjective out of education. We have to bring our heads and hearts back into integrity. The Elders Guild is working on these issues. Rabbi Lerner will be speaking tomorrow at 2 at the North Berkeley Senior Center. The Berkeley Historical Society, Bettina Apthecker, is their speaker for their big event. This is a window of opportunity for all of us to open our mouths in areas we haven't. It's time to declare peace in the battle of the sexes. It's time for brainstorming sessions, the buddy system, and to stop character assassinating and labeling people. There's an epidemic of that. And stop watching the clock every time somebody opens their mouth. These are complex issues. We need to have we used to have all night discussions. You know, until we work things out. I was married into the beat poetry world. In 65, they had a week-long convention here that never would have happened without the free speech movement, and most of my generation would never have opened our mouths. So please talk about the need for a movement for our seniors.
Won't be hard to do we're all here, right?
I think we're all going to be real advocates in that area, I can tell you. But your point's well taken.
Well, I
want
that
one, the man in the green has had.
Did I miss somebody?
You did miss him. He's the only
I'm
one.
So sorry.
I would make him the last guy.
I think
please.
Yeah.
He was. He give our last question.
He did have his hand. I did see. He did it after you had moved this way.
Oh, I didn't see him.
But he was the only one. Then I would say.
Thank you, and thank you, Jackie. My name is Stephen Saslow. I was the 20th person pulled out of the building from the fourth floor in a double hammer lock because I went limp. And 2 years ago, one of my shoulders had to be totally replaced. And it's a wonderful new bionic one. Grassroots point. So we were in that building, and when the police and them decided to come and get us out of there first or very soon, they papered over the windows from the inside with newspapers and masking tape so no one could see in what they were doing. And off we went through the night and the next day and afternoon to Santa Rita.
UC Santa Rita.
Yes, UCSR Rehabilitation Center. 784 of us in the cold winter with no heat. And when we were bailed out, and then we were brought back to the campus and deposited there the next day, the whole campus was struck. 784 of us came back to see 18,000 undergrads and 10,000 grads, professors, spouses, baby carriages. This entire campus was struck.
It was.
Grassroots. Almost magic. It was profound. The entire UC Berkeley community.
Thank you. Good note to end on. Good note to end on. Here we go. Here we go. Everybody. Here we go. Good note to end on.
Thank you.
One last word.
One last word.
Yeah, not so much summation, but it's something that I didn't get through. The various kinds of movements and activities I described generally ended up kind of petering out in one way or another. But one of the things that I didn't get to say was that in the last 5 to 6 years, I have begun to see a change that's very positive. Most of us in this room have a little gray or more gray, and we are not as active or as we once were. We don't participate at the same level we once did. And for a long time, it looked like, what happens when we move on? Will anybody be there to take our place? Will anybody be there to keep movements alive? And over the last 5 or 6 years, I have begun to see a kind of reawakening in many of the young people. I think the high, these astronomical student fees have been a part of it. But we're seeing students and young people start to organize around things like protesting against these high fees. The boycott movements have sprung up, and when you begin to see those and see those in action, you see a lot of young people. The disinvestment movements that are taking place, immigration, climate change, the environment, they're beginning to wake up that this is a world they're going to have to inherit, and financial inequality is starting to hit home. So it really looks like there will be new movements coming up to sort of man the barricades and continue the move for social equity and social change. So,
good end. Good end. Good end.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. All right, take care.